Buck Henry has been a frequent guest host of Saturday Night Live, and although he seemed perfectly in sync with the humor of the not-ready-for-primetime players, his work had already made it to primetime. He wrote for The Steve Allen Show, The Gary Moore Show, and co-created the spy spoof Get Smart. Henry also wrote the screenplays for The Graduate, Catch-22, and What's Up, Doc, and he co-directed the remake of Heaven Can Wait with Warren Beatty. You can see his latest work this month on the PBS comedy series Trying Times. It's an anthology about contemporary life with the emphasis on neurosis, despair, and hopelessness. Buck Henry directed the premiere episode Hunger Chic. Carrie Fisher and Griffin Dunn star as a self-absorbed yuppie couple preparing for dinner guests. Their daughter likes to watch a TV show that raises funds for starving children in Africa, but Carrie Fisher is afraid the show will detract from her perfect dinner party. Buck Henry plays the host of the TV show.
Little Abdul lives in a world without cash machines, VCRs, credit cards. He doesn't summer in the
Jennifer, if I've told you once, I've told you a thousand times, do not watch this show.
Why can't I watch it?
Because I said so.
It's not a reason.
You want a reason? Fine, I'll give you a reason. You see that little boy there?
His name is Abdul.
Well, he used to live in a nice big apartment just like you, and his mommy told him not to watch the Starving Children show. But he didn't listen to his mommy, just like you don't listen to me. So one day, when little Abdul was once again disobeying his mother, that evil man right there reached from inside the TV, grabbed little Abdul, and took him off to Starving Children's Land. And if you're not careful, the exact same thing is going to happen to you.
Now, you play the host in this of one of those syndicated Feed the Starving Children in Africa shows, and the phone number is 1-800-STARVE.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I want to know why you gave yourself that part, and also I'd like to know if you've watched a lot of these shows on TV.
The Starve shows?
Yeah.
Well, answering your questions in reverse order.
Yes.
Yeah, I have watched a lot of them. I particularly like the guy in the sort of Banana Republic suit that strides through the desert. The person I'm trying to be, in effect.
Yeah.
He's very well-tailored and very concerned. And I really seriously doubt that very many people go to bed any less hungry because he's out there. It's a fascinating phenomenon of, that thing about first world, third world relationship through television, through a medium screen, part of which I think is what the show is about. So in answer to your question, yeah, I watch those guys. I want to see them eaten by wild animals when they're out there walking around in the desert. I cast myself, one, because they asked me to play it, because they're extremely cheap. And there I was, another, a body with a SAG card on the set. Why not do it? And of course, because I'm greedy.
Uh-huh. And this episode of Trying Times called Hunger Chic, which is directed by Buck Henry, is the premiere episode, and it will be on in mid-October on public television stations. Now, I want to ask you about your name. I think you were given the name Buck Henry Zuckerman.
Mm-hmm.
Buck doesn't sound like a very Jewish name to me.
But weirdly enough, I was christened and confirmed in the Episcopalian Church.
Ah, Zuckerman sounds like a Jewish name to me.
It sounds like one to me, too. And my grandfather's nickname was Buck, so they gave it to me.
So
my uncle, this is one of the non-lies I'm telling you.
Okay.
My uncle, Harvey Zuckerman, was an Episcopalian minister. Go figure.
Oh, so a lot of people must have had a mistaken impression about your religious identity.
Actually, by the time I was in one of my college years, I figured out that the reason I was so phenomenally acceptable socially is because my Jewish friends thought I was Jewish and my Christian friends assumed I was Christian. Some from my name, some from my face.
Now, you were in the Army. What year did you go in the Army?
1950, the end of 1952.
Okay, now, you were in the 7th Army Repertory Company and toured with a musical comedy that you wrote and directed?
Ultimately, yeah.
Was this the beginning of your show business career?
No, it was the end of my Army career.
Well,
I had acted as a kid. I toured with Life with Father when I was about 16.
Oh.
15 or 16, on what was then called the subway circuit. It doesn't exist any longer. It was one of the great New York theatrical traditions. A company that sent shows out to all the suburbs, theaters, wonderful legit theaters that then existed in the Bronx and Brooklyn and Long Beach, and ultimately went, I think, as far as New Jersey and Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
But it ain't there any longer. We rehearsed the play in the basement of a movie theater on 42nd Street, a theater that was famous for showing foreign films. Foreign films in those days, of course, meant films in which women appeared with their clothes off.
Right.
And so we were rehearsing in the basement next to the gentleman's room. So it was interesting to be rehearsing this sort of all-American play and have guys wandering in and out, their raincoats loose, going up and down from, well, you get the picture.
Right. Buck Henry is my guest. After you got out of the Army, you launched this elaborate con, really, called CINA,
The Society for Indecency to Naked Animals.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to make any sense, does it?
No.
Well, it doesn't.
You explain it.
I can't. I only partly invented this. A friend of mine named Alan Abel, who has since become known as a kind of general American hoaxer, developed this notion. We were sitting around one day in a kind of ecstasy of unemployment and thought, well, it's time the American public congealed their attitudes about naked animals. So we invented this guy who I became, G. Clifford Prout Jr., who toured the country, well, not toured exactly, but popped up here and there, talking about the indecency of nudity in the animal kingdom and how it was resulting in juvenile delinquency and alcoholism and suicide in the American public.
And animals should be clothed.
They should be clothed at all times. I went around condemning zoos as the burlesque houses of the animal world and stuff like that. And, of course, a lot of people took it quite seriously, I'm proud to say.
Well, let me say that I happen to have the CINA theme song on our turntable, so I'm going to give it a spin.
I'm thrilled.
Here we go.
High on the wings of CINA, we fight for the future now. Let's clothe every pet and animal, whether dog, cat, horse, or cow. G. Clifford Prout, our president, he works for you and me. So clothe all your pets and join the march for worldwide decency. S-I-N-A.
You wrote the lyrics to that, right?
That's not me.
No, and that's not you singing.
That's Alan Abel, I think.
Right.
Because my voice is infinitely better, and I always accompany myself on the ukulele.
I don't think you're on this record.
No, of course not. What record is it?
It's called Inside CINA.
I never heard of it. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah,
I didn't know it existed.
Yeah.
I think I did write the lyrics. I think I wrote the song, but I'm not sure. Alan may have...
I think you wrote it because it's attributed to Prout, the president of CINA, which is you.
I've never made a dime off it, but it's a thing about idealism anyway. It doesn't matter.
What social attitudes of the time were you playing off of? Were there decency groups that you were particularly trying to lampoon with the Society for Indecency to Naked Animals?
Yes, there were. There were... It was generated out of some kind of attention to a move for censorship of something, but I can't remember specifically what it was. Of course, it's perfectly applicable now. Keep Jesse Helms clothed and hooded, or some movement like that.
So anyways, you went on talk shows as if this were for real?
Mm-hmm.
And who took you seriously? How far did you get?
I got pretty far. Well, it started on the Today Show. Garraway, I think, understood what it was about, but he always kept a straight face. Ultimately, it ended up, years later, every couple of years, something would happen, and somebody would ask me to appear as G. Clifford Prout. Finally, around 1961, I did an interview for CBS News from from the Griffith Park Zoo in Los Angeles. And I was I sang this in a marching song and was yammering on about naked yaks and stuff. And it went back east. I drove back east. By the time, 5 days later, when I got to New York, I found out that Walter Cronkite was not very happy because he had presented this as the last piece on the national news as a real thing. And then somebody said, no, no, look, see, we know who he is. Mm. And he was quite angry with the reporter who developed the story and with everyone around. As a, you know, I don't blame him. It never occurred to me that that would happen.
Do you think that Cinna helped your career? It got you a lot of publicity. It got you on national TV, but not as yourself.
Oh, no, not in the slightest. Nor did I really ever intend it to. I don't think it did anything except possibly make a few people leery of me when they knew who I was.
You co-created Get Smart with Mel Brooks.
True.
How did you come up with the idea? Do you remember the night or the day when the idea first came to you?
Well, it really came, I think, to Danny Melnick, who was one of the producers. And it was a year in which both Inspector Clouseau and James Bond were among the hottest properties in hottest characters in the world. And I think it was Danny who said, think about James Bond and think about Clouseau and see if it makes sense. And, of course, it immediately did. And that basically was the genesis of it.
Did you ever steal plot ideas for the spy spoof Get Smart from straight TV shows?
We tried to, but they got so twisted in the stealing that it was hard to figure out what we were stealing from. By the second year, I would do anything. You know, I used to watch Mission Impossible, I think was the main one I watched, to try and steal an idea. But when you tried to analyze their plots, they seemed so outrageously foolish that that we'd have to back up for our own silliness from them. We had a team of terrific writers who were very good at developing lunatic notions.
In 1968, I think it was, the film The Graduate came out, and you wrote the screenplay for that, mm-hmm. adapted from the novel.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to play what's become the most famous passage of dialogue from the movie, and then ask you how you wrote it.
Okay.
Here we go.
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
Exactly. How do you mean?
There's a great future in plastics. Think about it. Will you think about it?
Yes, I will.
I've said, that's a deal.
Well, for our listeners who haven't seen The Graduate lately or who've never seen it, I should mention that Dustin Hoffman just came home from college, from out-of-town college, and all of his parents' friends are there, and they're all giving him useless advice on how he should spend the rest of his life. So getting back to the plastics suggestion, mm-hmm. this was your line, right?
It was.
Yeah. So
you mean if I'd have used the word linoleum, I'd be cleaning streets today.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was suggesting.
It's probably true.
But plastics really did have resonance. I think that for young people who went to see the movie, it was just this perfect example of the most boring, impossible profession you could ever get into, exactly what you didn't want to be doing when you came home from college.
Yeah, well, that's actually, the word had by then already, had already come to mean that, in a sense. You know, plastic. I can't remember what the noun would be that would attach to it when it was used as an adjective. But like, you know, tin can democracy, plastic living, ersatz stuff. It already was something of a cliche in the certainly in the academic world that the word plastic meant everything that everyone feared was happening to a too rich, too smug, too happy country. And it also, it's good to say plastics has a good ring to it. The odd thing is I had a conversation with Nichols before he started shooting, and I said, I think maybe plastics is a little old-fashioned. Let me see if I can find a word that's more up to date. Fortunately, I couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Were there elements of the story of The Graduate that you related to yourself?
Yeah, and I wasn't the only one. Larry Turman, who produced it, and Mike Nichols, who directed it, and I all were about the same age. We'd all come out of various prep schools and colleges, and we all related to that. Sure, I think, and almost everybody did. That's what kept those kids coming.
So you related to the idea of coming home and having your parents' generation give you advice you couldn't use and try to retake control over your life?
Yeah, but I think it's probably, you know, it happened to be particularly relevant, or seemed to be particularly relevant to that generation, even though we, Nichols, Turman, I, and others connected with it, were writing essentially from a sort of 50s sensibility. It made sense to the 60s generation. So I suspect that that sense of, I'm afraid we're going to have to call it alienation, is something that happens, you know, every 10 or 15 years to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Buck Henry is my guest. I want to skip ahead to Saturday Night Live. Do you hold the record for guest hosting the program?
I used to. I think I hold the record for a number of hosts in small number of years, but I think Steve Martin has beat me finally.
Ah, okay.
I did 10 in the first 5 years.
Let me ask you about some of the characters that you played. One of them was Uncle Roy, the dirty uncle babysitter who mm-hmm. used to sit the two girls on his lap, and what was it, Gilda Radner and Lorraine Newman?
Yeah, he was a sort of a fond uncle child molester.
Right.
Now, a lot of people think you can't do comedy about that sort of stuff, but the fact is that you can.
How did you get this part? Did you write it?
No. What always interests me when excoriating letters come in is that it was written by the two of the female writers. It was written by Ann Beats and Rosie Schuster, who invented the character, handed it to me on a silver platter, and wrote all of them. I can't remember whether we did two or three, but Anne and Rosie wrote them with enormous affection and a tumultuous laughter. I mean, they loved the character, so how could I not? And I mean, the secret to it being that the little girls loved the guy. The secret to it being also that they weren't really little girls. I mean, they were Lorraine and Gilda, but they were little girls. I mean, it was all very ambivalent on mm-hmm. on an odd sexual level. But I used to get a lot of nasty mail. I had a rationalization for it, though, even if somebody did make me feel guilty. My rationalization was that when I looked into the camera at the end of one or two of them and said, "Oh, don't worry, honey, you're not alone. There are Uncle Roys everywhere," or something like that, is I had this rationalization, which might be thought of as a fantasy, that there were thousands of little girls, little boys, or someone turning, you know, to look at some member of their family watching the show with them and saying, "Oh, yeah, yeah, there is. There's one here, Dad," or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I think the number of times that you hosted Saturday Night Live is an example of how your humor has bridged several generations, and I think that that's something that can't always be said of humorists. Like, some humorists see the absurdity around them in the immediate kind of a generation that they grew up with.
You mean,
and don't get beyond that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? They
get old and dull.
Yeah, yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. No, but you know what I mean.
And the jokes aren't funny, and the attitudes are decayed.
Well, some people, that they're still making jokes that might have been funny 20 years mm-hmm. ago, but that don't work anymore. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that ever happened with you.
That's why, that's why I kept from being a stand-up comic.
What do you mean that's why you kept from being a stand-up comic?
Well, if you stay away from, if you sort of attack from the outside, stand-up comics have a really tough row to hoe. They got to stand right in there in the middle of when the Indians are circling and sort of shoot what few bullets they have left. You either fight from inside the wagons, or you ride around the wagons with the Indians and shoot in. Now, I feel that you should be way outside the Indians, lurking in the mountains behind a rock with a howitzer, preferably. And that's as far as I'm going to go.
Okay. What kind of projects are you working on now?
I'm in the middle of a film script. I'm going to start rehearsing a play in a few weeks here in New York. That's all I can remember.
You know what I never understand about people who are in film or television? What do you do in between projects when there isn't a show or a movie for a few weeks or for a few months?
Most actors suffer. A lot of writers just keep writing. I'll do anything to get the in-betweens. I love the in-betweens. I travel. I mean, I'm about to leave town and go on a trip. I'll go to any country. I'll do anything. I'll do any excuse not to work.
Okay. Thank you a lot for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure.